The morning was crisp. The air was a little cooler than it was yesterday afternoon when it reached almost 80 degrees. Some of us are discarding our shorts and putting on long pants, getting back to wearing a sweater. Of course, we're talking about the first days of fall, also known as the season of pumpkin spice and everything nice. But like the falling leaves and cooling temperature, there's a debate that happens every year. Autumn or fall? The pre-winter season of apple cider and colorful leaves goes by either autumn or fall. They're synonymous. Autumn, a word dating back to the late 1300s, became popular as an alternative to the word that was then used, harvest. And the word fall likely comes from the fall of the leaves or falling of the leaves. Those were phrases that poets would use. And according to Merriam-Webster, people shortened the phrase to the single word fall in the 1600s. Fall is the word of choice here in America. Autumn is the go-to in Britain. It wasn't until the 1800s that American English and British English took unofficial stance on these words. It's still unclear why America clings so strongly to fall. Some speculate it has to do with daylight saving time. Spring forward, fall back. So this morning I'm going to fall, excuse the pun, back in time to the early 1800s as a framework for focusing on poets and poetry. That's when we, Unitarian Universalists, received a tremendous influence from the philosopher and theologian, poet, Ralph Waldo Emerson. His claim was that God, humanity, and nature interconnected, they're unified, and that as humans, we can come to understand that unity through personal experience, that no written or human intermediary is required for this transaction to develop. We are here as UUs because we hold that humans possess the capacity to discern what is true and beautiful and can act in accordance with those discoveries. In his introduction to his essay, Emerson in 1836 suggests that rather than relying on religious authority and tradition to understand the world, we should spend time in nature and intuit answers for ourselves. And we shouldn't just observe nature. We should actively consider what nature means or does to us in transformational ways. In chapter one, Emerson advocates for spending time alone in nature. For example, by looking up at the stars away from city lights, you can find a greater transcendence to the world. Emerson describes this as experiencing sublimity. This refers to a lived experience of intense, overwhelming emotion that transcends the plain ordinariness of everyday living. Emerson suggests that nature produces such a state within us. Enjoying solitude in nature separates a person from the normal ordinariness of living. Most people like the star or take the stars for granted since they shine nightly. But if a person opens themselves up to nature's influence and adopts a simple, childlike, curious, nature, you will be captivated and you will find yourself in a enlarged sense of awesomeness. In chapter 6, Emerson suggests that through words, and particularly through symbols, the poet is the one who is able to guide the reader to see the world from new angles and perspectives, transforming our vision of ourselves and the world. So, let's begin by exploring autumn through the eyes of poets. First, John Keats. Keats often explored themes of nature and the passage of time in his poetry. And in his Ode to Autumn, he celebrates the season as a time of abundance, maturity, reflecting on its beauty, but also its passing quickly from our eyes. Season of mists and mellow fruitfulness, close bosom friend of the maturing sun, conspiring with him how to load and bless with fruit the vines that round the thatch eaves run, to bend with apples the mossed cottage trees, and fill all fruit with ripeness to the core, to swell the gourd and plump the hazel shells with a sweet kernel, to set budding more and still more later flowers for the bees, until they think warm days will never cease, for summer has o'erbrimmed their clammy cells. Who hath not seen thee oft amid the store? Sometimes whoever seeks abroad may find thee sitting careless on a granary floor, thy hair soft lifted by the winnowing wind, or in a half-reaped furrow sound asleep, drowsed with the fume of poppies, while thy hook spares the next swath and all its twined flowers. And sometimes, like a gleaner thou dost keep steady thy laden head across a brook, or by a cider press with patient look thou watchest the last oozings hours by hours. Where are the songs of spring? Aye, where are they? Think not of them, thou hast thy music too, while barred clouds bloom the soft dying day and touch the stubble plains with rosy hue. Then in a wailful choir the small gnats mourn among the river sallows, borne aloft or sinking as the light wind lives or dies. And full-grown lambs loud bleat from hilly bone. Hedge crickets sing, and now with treble soft, the redbreast whistles from a garden croft. Gathering swallows twitter in the skies. Keats explores a number of themes in To Autumn. He describes the lush, abundant landscapes of autumn, celebrating the rich colors and sounds and textures. The passage of time reflects on the transition from the ripeness of autumn to the barrenness of winter. And then there's a sense that nature is dying and it's not going to last forever what we are embracing. Keats subtly addresses the theme of mortality, using autumn as a metaphor for the later stages of life, where beauty and productivity are at their peak, but also nearing an end. Then there's the sensory experience, listening to the oozing of the apples and the making of apple cider. Keats emphasizes the sensory richness of autumn, hearing the crickets sing, engaging the reader's senses through the detailed imagery of sights, sounds, and smells. These themes collectively highlight Keats's appreciation for the natural world and his contemplation of life's fleeting yet bountiful, beautiful moments. our next poem by Robert Frost. And Frost is no stranger to us. He's in our hymnal, hymn number 64, "Oh, Give Us Pleasure in the Flowers Today." Frost frequently uses nature as a backdrop for exploring complex human emotions and philosophical questions. Here is "After Apple Picking." "My long two-pointed ladder sticking through a tree toward heaven still, and there's a barrel that I didn't fill beside it, and there may be two or three apples I didn't pick upon some bough. But I am done with apple picking now. A sense of winter sleep is on the night, the scent of apples. I'm drowsing off. I cannot rub the strangeness from my sight I got from looking through a pane of glass I skimmed this morning from the drinking trough and held against the world of hoary grass. It melted, and I let it fall and break. But I was well upon my way to sleep before it fell, and I could tell what form my dreaming was about to take. Magnified apples appear and disappear, stem end and blossom end, and every fleck of russet showing clear. My instep arch not only keeps the ache, it keeps the pressure of a ladder round. I feel the ladder sway as the boughs bend, and I keep hearing from the cellar bin the rumbling sound of load on load of apples coming in. For I have had too much for apple picking. I'm overtired of the great harvest I myself desired. There were 10,000 fruit to touch, cherish in hand, lift down, and not let fall. For all that struck the earth, no matter if not bruised and spiked with stubble, went surely to the cider apple heap as of no worth. One can see what will trouble this sleep of mine. Whatever sleep it is, were he not gone, the woodchuck would say whether it's like his long sleep, as I describe its coming on, or just some human sleep." Several themes are expressed in this "After Apple Picking." It reflects the transition from autumn to winter, the passage of time, the cycles of life, and then work and fatigue. The speaker's weariness from apple picking serves as a metaphor for the exhaustion that comes from life's labors and the pursuit of one's goals. And then there's a sense of regret. The poem explores the dual feelings of satisfaction and regret. While the speaker has accomplished much, there is a sense of incompleteness, of missed opportunities. And then there's dreams and reality. The blurred line between the speaker's dreams and reality highlights the introspective nature of his poem as the speaker reflects on his experience and the long sleep that he's desiring. These themes collectively delve into the complexity of our human experience, the inevitability of aging, and the introspective contemplation of one's life and one's achievements. And let us now move to our third poem. Mary Oliver has three of her writings in our hymnal: number 490, "Wild Geese," number 536, "Morning Poem," and 696, "To Live in This World." She is known for her keen observation of the natural world and its spiritual significance. Her poems often find beauty and wisdom in the changing seasons, encouraging readers to find solace and inspiration in nature. This is called "The Journey." One day you finally knew what you had to do and began, though the voices around you kept shouting their bad advice, though the whole house began to tremble, and you felt the old tug at your ankles, "Mend my life," each voice cried, but you didn't stop. You knew what you had to do, though the wind pried with its stiff fingers at the very foundations, though their melancholy was terrible. It was already late enough and a wild night and the road full of fallen branches and stones. But little by little, as you left their voices behind, the stars began to burn through the sheets of clouds, and there was a new voice, which you slowly recognized as your own, that kept you company as you strode deeper and deeper into the world, determined to do the only thing you could do, determined to save the only life you could save. Now, in The Journey, Mary Oliver doesn't explicitly focus on autumnal themes. Instead, it centers on personal transformation and self-discovery. However, if you were to draw parallels to autumnal themes, we could consider these themes as embedded into her words. Transition and change. Much like autumn signifies a period of change, the journey is about personal transition. The speaker embarks on a path of self-discovery, leaving behind old constraints and moving toward a new beginning. Letting go. Autumn is a time when trees shed their leaves, symbolizing the act of letting go. Similarly, the poem speaks to the necessity of letting go of external pressures and voices to find one's own true inner voice. And then inner strength and renewal. Autumn can also be seen as a time of inner strength, preparing for the renewal that comes with spring. In The Journey, the speaker finds inner strength to overcome obstacles and renew their sense of self. Each of the poems that we have shared this morning offer a unique perspective on autumn, using the season to delve into deeper themes of living, dying, and renewal, and more, much more. But I shall conclude with this from Mary Oliver. It's called Wild Geese. And I heard the geese this morning flying over by Lake Monona, where we live. You do not have to be good. You do not have to walk on your knees for 100 miles through the desert repenting. You only have to let the soft animal of your body love what it loves. Tell me about despair, yours, and I will tell you mine. Meanwhile, the world goes on. Meanwhile, the sun and the clear pebbles of the rain are moving across the landscapes, over the prairies and the deep trees and the mountains and the rivers. Meanwhile, the wild geese, high in the clear blue air, are heading home again. Whoever you are, no matter how lonely, the world offers itself to your imagination, calls to you like the wild geese, harsh and exciting over and over, announcing your place in the family of things. Maybe sometime during the week, when you're loading or unloading the dishwasher, you'll let your imagination take you to a place where you recall a time of autumnal beauty or a moment of joyful transformation. So may it be. Our closing words by Jim Hobart. Jim was a classmate of mine back in the late 50s at Meadville Seminary. Jim passed away a few years ago. He writes these: "As we depart one from another, let our hearts be secure through every human season. Let our hearts be secure in seasons of anguish as in seasons of joy, in seasons of failure as in seasons of success, in seasons of uncertainty as in seasons of security. Let our hearts be secure in this dual reality. We are worthy recipients of love and support we can never earn, and we are worthy providers of love and support others cannot earn. Let our hearts be secure, for hearts know and understand and will respond if invited in.